trying to pass these things around so you can look at them. And these are some of the things I'm going to talk about. These are Australasian tektites. They were formed 790,000 years ago in a big impact that occurred somewhere in Southeast Asia. But we're not really, we never found the crater, although it must be pretty big, because the ejecta spread out over at least a tenth of the surface of the Earth. And these are big, biggest things that flew thousands of kilometers from the impact site. I'm going to mostly talk about smaller ones. They're glass. No.
That was a trailer.
But we have a treat, you know, it was already announced in spot. But I wanted to remind everyone that there is wine and cheese today at 5 in the Commons Room.
Okay, so I'm going to pass them around. I'm not really giving the talk yet, but I want to pass these around. These are glass, so don't throw them at anyone. They've been lying on the ground, these particular ones, in the Philippines, for 790,000 years, so they're a little bit eroded. If you want to see what they look like on the inside, this one we tried to cut, it exploded. So you can see, it looks like obsidian glass, although it isn't. And here's one that just broke. They're not very valuable. But these two, one time I passed around a piece of meteorite that was worth several $100,000, and I got nervous at that. Okay, these two are valuable to me because they're a present. But you can buy them for $40 or something, I don't know. Okay, so let's take a look. Okay, so first I'm going to say a few words about the phenomenology of this subject. Then I'm going to tell you, I'm going to summarize how I think these things are produced. In particular, how much more abundant ones that are much smaller are produced. These are the tail end of the distribution of these objects. And then what it has to do with turbulence. So first I tried to prepare a very simple set of equations that has only a little bit of poetic license in it so that you can follow the dynamics of the turbulence. All you really need to know, there are two things you need to know about turbulence for this talk. The first one is that if you have a turbulent flow and you look at points in the fluid that are separated by some distance r, that the RMS velocity difference between those point scales is r to the 1/3 power. This is Kolmogorov scaling. It's equivalent to the spectrum, the 1D spectrum with k to the minus 5/3. And the second thing you have to know is a little bit more subtle, although in this particular case not as subtle as it is in other cases. And that is, if you have turbulence, incompressible turbulence, and you expand it, that it adiabatically cools. It cools like a monatomic gas. Once you know that, you can follow everything, I think. Okay, so now these events, these big impacts that throw material over large distances, they don't occur very frequently. The Australasian impact, of which these are samples of the ejecta, as I said, occurred about 790,000 years ago. The date's very, very well known from radioactive dating, potassium-argon dating from fission tracks that show up in the glass and can be etched with hydrofluoric acid. From the places that they're found in the seafloor, which can be dated with magnetostratigraphy, and so on. And it's the most recent one. There are several others in which the craters are actually identified, so we know these were terrestrial impacts. For a long time, there was a debate as to whether these were impacts on the moon or impacts on the Earth. But now we know, since we've been to the moon and we know what the rocks are like, that these, and we also found craters on Earth associated with these, that these were terrestrial impacts, and mostly in terrestrial sedimentary rock. Okay, now, some of the other notable impacts were the impact that produced the North American tektites. This occurred 35 million years ago, and it formed a good part of Chesapeake Bay. And it took until about a decade ago to actually identify the crater. And the North American tektites are found, well, they're found in Georgia and Texas and various places. But the microtektites, the sub-millimeter size spherules, which came out of that impact, are found in the seafloor. Not found in land because they don't last in land. Things that small don't last in land. They're found in the seafloor, and they're found in the seafloor all the way down to the Weddell Sea in the border of the Antarctic. The Australasian impact ejecta, the microtektites, are found in thin layers in the seafloor, layers that are typically 10 centimeters or so thick. And they're found all the way down, all throughout the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. And recently, some microtektites that are probably associated with the Australasian ones have been found in the crest of the Trans-Antarctic Mountains, just a few of them. So these are distributed very, very widely after an impact. There's also a similar micro spherules, although by now altered by having their minerals replaced, found in the seafloor and also on land in formations that used to be in the seafloor that were lifted up, associated with the KT boundary impact, the one that may or may not have extinguished the dinosaurs, but certainly got rid of a lot of species. And these form a worldwide layer, as far as can be seen, something like a millimeter thick deposit globally. This is a global ejecta. Okay, now in order to travel this far, the ejecta had to be launched with velocities of several kilometers per second, at least. And furthermore, enough of it had to be launched all at once so that the atmosphere didn't stop it. Because those of you that never thought about it know that if you shoot a gun, even a high-speed rifle, the bullet, it's not going to get very far. And in order to brush the atmosphere aside, the amount of melt that has to be ejected has to be comparable to a cubic mass of atmosphere of order of scale height. This, given the density of the atmosphere being about 10 to the minus 3 grams per cc, corresponds to a mass of ejecta, which corresponds to maybe a cubic kilometer of melt. Unless you have an impact that's big enough to give you that, you only get local, at least on the Earth, you only get local ejecta blankets. You don't get global, or because you can't penetrate the atmosphere with any significant velocity. Okay, so the first thing I want to talk about is a little bit about what happens in one of these ejecta, why turbulence is almost certainly relevant. It's amazing that it wasn't recognized previously, and how this turbulence gives rise to melt objects, and why the vast majority of them are sub-millimeter-sized spherules. and only a very rare fraction are these big things. Okay, so what happens in an impact? Well, an impact on Earth occurs always at somewhat more than the escape velocity from Earth, because it's a big thing, which the atmosphere doesn't bother coming in. 20 kilometers per second may be a sort of typical thing. And what happens then is the impacting body, it stays coherent through the atmosphere. It buries itself a few diameters or a couple diameters into the ground, and a shock wave precedes it into the ground, and a shock wave goes back into the ejecta. And at velocities like this, the shock wave melts the impactor, the projectile. It also melts a comparable volume or somewhat greater volume of material in the ground, and even vaporizes a little. And the high-speed ejecta that I'm talking about then is mostly molten. In some cases, it may start off is mainly vapor. And because there's a free surface on the Earth and there's this high pressure shocked material which is in contact with that free surface, a rarefaction wave goes into the shocked material that releases the overpressure and accelerates the material upward. And that's how the material gets ejected. Of course, the stuff that I'm showing you and talking about eventually comes down. That's another part entirely. It has to come down through the atmosphere, and it comes down pretty much the same velocity that it goes up. And I'm not going to say very much about that. And then if it lands on the seafloor, it's in flight maybe for a few minutes. It lands on the seafloor. It forms a thin layer on the seafloor, and if not for bioturbation, that is the wee beasties on the seafloor stirring things up, these layers would be even much thinner than they are. And in fact, in places where the seafloor is very old, predates the formation of much of life, you actually see that the layers of these spherules are thinner than the current or the last few million year layers are. Okay, so that's the general phenomenology. Okay, now why turbulence? Well, when this melt comes out of the ground, it essentially condensed matter density. Of course, initially, when it's shocked, it gets the densities that are 2 to 3 times higher than ordinary zero pressure densities. But when it comes out, it has densities comparable to zero pressure material. It then spreads out and it breaks up. It has to break up. It can't stay uniform, so it breaks up. And the question is, when it breaks up, what does it break up into? Okay, now unless you suspend belief, it seems to me that the impact itself has to be turbulent. There's no demonstration of this, even from hydrocode computation, although it should be possible to do that. The Reynolds numbers in the melt behind the shock are extremely high. The dimensions are kilometers, the velocities are kilometers per second, and the viscosities, to the degree that they can be measured or inferred, the temperatures that are reached are comparable or probably less than that of water. So the Reynolds numbers are enormous. They're astronomical, 10 to the 12. Probably even a little bit higher. Now this is not a guarantee, as those of you who study turbulence know, of turbulence, but it's a pretty good indicator that without some special symmetry or stable stratification, that you're likely to have turbulence. Furthermore, when the stuff comes out of the ground, it comes out at any given time over a range of radii from the impact place. And an ejecta curtain is formed through the collision of streams coming out from somewhat different places. And that's even more likely to produce a turbulence. So we have a turbulence now of these, some sort of fluid which has high density portions and low density portions. Now, at first, this is a hard point. At first, this material, at least if it's mostly, almost all melt, is a very compressible form of turbulence. Because you have these drops, their relative velocities are small compared to local velocities at which they collide. You can think of them as the molecules, the drops as the molecules. Their relative velocities are small compared to the streaming and turbulent velocities. And very high Mach number compressible turbulence is difficult problem. And unfortunately, I don't think it's terribly important for this story, because even at the temperatures and the minimum entropies that go along with them that are needed to throw things thousands of kilometers, there's enough vapor around so that as the turbulence expands, adiabatically cools and so on, the Mach number of the turbulent flow is actually not very high. I can talk about that more, but I'm going to skip that for the moment. So what I want to first do is just talk about a turbulence of drops and treat it as though it were incompressible turbulence. You can think of there being a background, a low-density background of hot gas, which is enough on the large scales to keep the system stiff, to keep the turbulence essentially incompressible. And on the small scales, not so important as to produce a lot of Stokes drag or gas drag. And therefore, the main interactions of the drops are collisions among the drops. So that's the picture.
When you talk about drops, it's not a continuous medium. It's really consists of
this is a blob. It's once it expands to a volume much greater than the volume it had in the ground, it's broken up. And the question is, what does it break up into? And that's what I want to address.
There's no role in the fields in this.
Well, there's an Earth's magnetic field, and there's probably some remnant magnetism, and some of this stuff that has little bits of iron in it. But dynamically, it's totally unimportant. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the material is mostly neutral, too. It's not shock so high that when it comes out of the ground that you get a lot of ionization or anything like that. Okay, so now I want to imagine that we have a fluid with some velocity on large scale, U sub L. Outer scale, the turbulence is L. And we have some turbulent spectrum so that on some scale, lambda much less than L, really only a little bit less than L, the velocity of the eddies can be thought of as having the Kolmogorov scaling. And I want to ask, what is the velocity that drops of size S? So we have a drop size S. What is the velocity which that drop will meet another drop when they collide? Now, the only thing that's holding these drops together is surface tension. We want to know, you have drops of size S and they're colliding at some velocity. How big are they going to be if they're only protected or maintained by surface tension? Viscosity at these temperatures is not very important. Okay, the temperatures, I'm not going to show you the thermodynamics here, but the temperatures at which this stuff comes out of the ground, probably about 5,000 degrees Kelvin, and then there's a cooling as the material expands just from sweating. The drops, as they get farther apart, more vapor is produced, maybe several percent vapor, and that's enough to drop the temperature by a factor of 2. So we're talking about temperatures from 5,000 degrees to maybe 2,000 degrees.
So okay. It's not clear why you can use incompressible law for something which basically a set of particles, droplets are.
Because there's
no pressure
stiff,
of.
Because there's a stiff vapor, which has a sound speed. The vapor has a sound speed of a kilometer per second. It's a heavy vapor. It's mostly SiO and O2. It has a sound speed of a little bit more than a kilometer per second. Even if there's only 10% or 5% or 3% vapor, if you take the sound speed of the vapor plus the drops, and that sound speed is much higher than the velocity of which the drops fly, then also the velocity of the eddies, once the eddies have cooled a bit by expanding.
So the point is that the pressure of vapor must be enough to equalize density of droplets. Actually, when I say incompressible, it says that density of droplets is the same everywhere.
That's right.
So the pressure of vapor is supposed to be enough.
It's plenty enough. So on large scales, it's an incompressible fluid in which the mass is mainly drops, but the stiffness is all coming from the vapor. But we're forgetting the vapor here. We know it's there, but otherwise can't give a blackboard talk. Okay. So we have drops of size S. Okay, so now what's the mean free path of these drops? Well, for the moment, since I'm doing this all in a box and I haven't talked about the expanding system, we're going to just talk now about a uniform system. We'll take epsilon to be the mean density over the density of the drop. So you can think of epsilon as being some small parameter which just gives the filling factor of the liquid. And the values that are sort of important here between 10 to the minus 3 and maybe 10 to the minus 6 from my system. So what's the mean free path? Well, if we have drops of size S, the mean free path is going to be of order S divided by epsilon. When the drops are touching each other, when we're just at condensed matter density, drop can only move its own distance before it collides with another one. And then when things are expanded so that the mean density is...
Not epsilon 1/3?
No. It's epsilon. It's epsilon. The number density of drops goes as epsilon. So this is just the size of drop divided by the number density, right? Okay? No?
S squared.
It's a cross-section.
No, it's not a cross-section. It's a mean free path.
But S is...
No, S is the drop size. It's linear.
Diameter.
Yeah, right.
Right? Is that okay? Okay, I can do it with N sigma. Go on. Okay?
I would say that epsilon is S over lambda cube.
Oh, well, we're going to have to get this one straight, right?
Epsilon
here is
dimensionless.
Yeah.
The power could be anything.
No, but you could put it in a third. That's his point.
Uh-huh. Density, it has the epsilon in it, right? Yes.
And
But sigma would have to show.
No, but it has the number density, remember. N is the number density divided by x cubed. And this is s squared. So this is s divided by epsilon. Okay? This is the volume of a drop, and this is the number of drops per unit volume. So it's epsilon over s cubed times s squared.
Okay.
This is the mean free path, and now let's think about what this means in the physical context for the moment. Although again, I want to come back to the box as quickly as possible. I'm going to be talking about these microtektites, and I didn't bring it. Well, I did bring some, but you can't see them; they're too small. I have 100 in a little test tube. So these are submillimeters, typically for the oscillation impact, typically 100 microns or so, 10 to minus 2 centimeters. And the initial sphere of material, liquid melt, when it comes out of the ground is, or the blob of it, is maybe a kilometer in size to be able to brush aside the atmosphere. So then the question is, how much does it have to expand before it becomes optically thin, before you can no longer see through it? Well, initially, if S is 10 to the minus 2, then the mean free path is 10 to the minus 2 centimeters. If you then want to get the mean free path up to the size of the system of blobs as they expand, and you work this all out, you'll see that the mean free path only becomes comparable to the size of the system of blobs when the overall cloud of blobs or droplets is expanded to several thousand kilometers, a few thousand kilometers. So this system is extremely self-contained. It keeps in its vapor. It keeps out the atmosphere. The atmosphere doesn't make any difference. Vapor is contained in it. In fact, it even keeps its photons in for a long time. When you actually work things out, the photons don't start to get out in sufficient number to really cool what's going on in the interior beyond just what you get from the production of vapor and a little bit of adiabatic expansion until the system is maybe 500 kilometers across. Okay, so now let's just go back to this after this little discussion. Let's go back to ask, how fast do these drops collide? Well, the collision velocity, if it's only drops and they're only mean free path effects are due to collisions among the drops, then an individual drop's velocity relative to the sort of mean flow, you can think of a mean flow here, is going to be given by the turbulent velocity across a distance comparable to lambda, to the mean free path. Because drops are going to be coming from distances before they collide, separated by what are the mean free path, and they're going to carry velocity information over that distance. So if we ask what is the collision velocity, so the collision velocity that's going to be of order, so I'll call that W of S, that's going to be of order U at lambda of S at the mean free path here. And that's then going to be of order U, the outer scale velocity, times S over L to the 1/3, and then epsilon to the 1/3. Okay, so that's the velocity that these things are going to collide. Now, if they're colliding at this velocity and they're only held together by surface tension, we can now work how big they can be, or at least how big the typical drops are going to be. Very rare drops can be much bigger, and we'll come back to that. That's why you can have things like this. Okay, so how big can a typical velocity be? Well, a typical drop can be, well, we balance the kinetic energy of collision, rho s cubed ws squared, against the surface tension. This is the coefficient of surface tension, sigma. I can never decide whether it's sigma or gamma. Depends on your subject. Now, sigma, just so we orient ourselves, sigma for molten silicates is around 300 ergs per centimeter squared, or dynes per centimeter. For water, it's about 60 or 70 at room temperature. And of course, this is just related to the cohesive energy. Cohesive energy for silicates are higher. The melting temperature is higher by several. The vaporization energy is higher by several compared to water. So that's straightforward. It's even measured and not very sensitive to temperature. So this tells us that S here itself, and I'll call this S min, because I'm going to show you later that we can have bigger ones, although rare. S min is the order sigma over rho ws squared. And of course ws depends upon S. So we have to plug that in here and then solve. And if we do that, we get S min over L going like sigma over rho U squared L. I think it's 3/5. And I forget the epsilon, right? That's the only other thing. So when I put in here for WS squared, I get an epsilon to the 2/3 up here, and then I take the 3/5 power, so I guess I get epsilon to 2/5. Okay, so that's what tells me what the size of the drops are. So if we're given turbulence in steady, we can think of this as being even in steady state, where I have an underdensity epsilon compared to the density of the liquid, then this is the size of the drops we expect. Now you can also go back to this equation, since we know the size of the drops. We know sigma, we know rho. Rho is a little less than 3 grams per centimeter cubed for these liquid silicates. And you could work out what the collision velocity must have been. And for 10 to the minus 2 centimeters, the collision velocity is about a meter per second. So these drops that we find spread out over the seafloor, all over the Earth, if this is really how they had their velocities, I mean their sizes determined, must have been colliding at something like a meter per second. On the other hand, they were shot out of this flow, this impact, at least several kilometers per second. Otherwise, they wouldn't have ended up where they ended up. Okay. Now, this object, just to give you some feeling, this object was only found in the Philippines, so it's not going to fly all that far. And it's comparable to the size of the biggest object that made it to Australia, which is 5,000 kilometers from where the impact occurred in Southeast Asia. So objects this size managed to fly 5,000 kilometers, just held together by surface tension. Actually, this one was also rotating. I'll come to that later. So that says that the collisions are at a much lower velocity. These are a very quiet flow. That's why without the vapor, it wouldn't be anything like an incompressible fluid. And it wasn't like an incompressible fluid initially, because initially there wasn't much vapor. The vapor only starts to reach its maximum after the drops have separated by quite a bit. Okay, so this is minimum size. Now, you might think this is the end of the story, although we know we have things like this. But it isn't, and that is because a big drop, as long as it doesn't collide with any other big drops, just collides with a little drop, is completely happy in a turbulent flow of little drops, because the kinetic energy brought in by the little drop is hitting the big drop is much less than the big drop's surface energy. By the way, everybody should know the surface tension arises because on the boundaries of a liquid they're missing bonds, right? So there's an energy penalty, and that's why things tend to minimize their surface area, liquids, by becoming spheres if there's nothing preventing them from being spheres. Okay, so then you can work out, in addition for this just a simple model, what is the biggest drop that you could possibly have? Because you have to figure out first what limits the size of the biggest drop. Okay, and the way you go about that is you realize that if you have a very big drop, it's moving faster because it has a larger mean free path. Its mean free path is still given by this expression. It has a bigger mean free path, and therefore it samples larger eddies. It has larger velocity relative to the field, the local field of small drops, plowing through the small drops. And there's a limit to how fast the big drop can plow through the small drops, because the small drops then produce a pressure, basically, on the front of the big drop. You can think of the small drops as not moving, and the big drop is just moving through a stationary front of small drops. Very similar to what happens when you have a raindrop that falls under gravity. If a raindrop gets bigger than a few millimeters, then it starts to flatten out because the gravitational force and terminal velocity is balanced by drag or ram pressure. And if the flattening becomes too big, then the minimum surface is achieved by bifurcating into two drops. This is also should be familiar to nuclear physicists, in case there are any of them still alive. that was very nice. That's because I was at Caltech and we had all these debates about nuclear physics. Okay.
But when you talk about, mean free path, now you need to kind of be, to define what you actually mean. Mean free path with respect to momentum transfer. Because if you
don't have that's what I mean. Sizes. That's what I mean. It's basically the stopping time.
Okay.
Because the stopping time then can be matched to the eddy turnover time. Incidentally, one of the postdocs at Caltech, Brant Robertson, who works on galaxy formation, I told him about this, and he quickly put together a simulation and showed the big drops, turbulence simulation, and he put in some tracer particles, put in the right drag force, and he found that he got a scaling when he used this law of drag, in which the random velocities relative to the background of the fluid scaled as the 1/3 power of the size of the body. Yeah, because all of this stuff, with eddies and turbulence and stuff, it's all sort of, Yeah, anyway, so now how big can a big drop be? Well, a big drop can be as big as what you would get if you took the epsilon times rho, which is the density of the background fluid, and you multiply that by the square of the velocity, so this is the ram pressure, and now we'll put a maximum here. We set that, that's the ram pressure, we set that equal basically the excess pressure that you get inside the drop from surface tension. So this is an energy, sigma is an energy per unit area. We divide by the size of the drop, you get energy per unit volume, which is in fact the excess pressure that's produced inside a drop because of its surface tension. So we can solve this now for S max.
So if left side is larger, then the droplet breaks or what?
Yeah, well, it bifurcates, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So it's hard to make a drop bigger than that. So we can solve this equation as well. And we get S max over L goes like, I think it's 1/5 here. Okay, so that says that S max of S min is 1 over epsilon to the 3/5. Now I'm going to tell you that when we get more serious here, that epsilons are about 10 to minus 3 typically. So we get a factor of 100, more or less 100 in the size, and a million in the mass. But these big drops, I'm not going to do the distribution right away anyway, if I do it at all. But these big drops have to be rare, because if a big drop meets another big drop, that's the end. In fact, not only does a big drop have to avoid meeting a big drop of the same size, it has to avoid meeting drops that are quite a bit smaller. And that means that the spectrum of these drops has to be very, very steep. The growth rate of the drop, an individual drop, is produced by accreting little drops, but the destruction is produced by meeting a critical size drop, which is quite a bit smaller than the big drop, at least for drops that are much bigger than this minimum size. And that defines a very steep spectrum. And that's why nobody has ever found a big drop in the seafloor core, because the amount of area that's been explored in the seafloor core is very, very small. So on the seafloor, we only find these little ones. On the land, we find only the big ones, because the little ones are gone. But of course, if something flies all over the earth, everything is going to land in the sea. Everything is going to land on the land. It's just a question of what you can find.
You can also work out the distribution of electricity.
Oh yeah, I'll talk about that too, but only a little. Because I want to get on to what happens in an expanding now cloud of drops. And, you know, time is going. So everybody has important work to do. Yeah, I hope. Okay. It was very nice here, you know. Okay. So now let's talk about what happens if you have a sphere that's expanding. And the best way to look at this, although it's not perfect, is to imagine there was an impact here, it created some crater, and a sphere of material went out like that, at some velocity v, it's expanding at some velocity u0. And it's this stuff that's turbulent, and we want to ask what happens to the drop. And we can partition for a given shock velocity the internal energy into a directed piece, and then an internal piece here, internal energy here, and also a turbulent energy there. And you can stick it into some simple programming. How come the drops? Okay, so what goes on here? Well, in this case, epsilon, we can think of this as having radius r. R is equal to u0 times t. Actually, u0 can change a little bit too, due to internal energy being converted to kinetic energy and turbulent energy being converted into a combination of expansion energy and also dissipation into entropy. But for the moment, I'll just consider this as uniformly expanding. So we have this, and we can define a little r, which is equal to capital R divided by R0, where R0 is the size of this ball of drops when the drops were all touching each other, when the stuff was coming out of the ground. Okay, and then epsilon is of order 1 over R cubed. Now, I'm going to assert, so this is your chance now to complain about this, if you dare. I'm going to assert that the turbulent velocity, U of lambda, is going to be of order U0 over R times lambda over R to the 1/3. And this prefactor is the important one. I'm saying that if you have a ball like this in which the terminal velocity is comparable to the expansion velocity, that the turbulence is going to cool off as the ball expands like this. And this is just conservation of vorticity. Right? Imagine any circuit in here. That circuit of fluid particles is going to expand proportional to its R here, and the velocity of the integrator around that circuit is going to decay as 1 over R. This has also been verified in a computer calculation by Brandt. This part at least was obvious to me. Okay, now of course R here is also growing. So across any fixed scale, the turbulent velocity is going to decay. Fixed scale lambda is going to decay as 1 over little r to the 4/3 power. So you get an extra little r here. That's the cooling of the turbulence, and that's really essential. Because that's what brings the velocities down from kilometers per second to much smaller values. Okay, so that's an essential part. On this. So there's sort of two essential parts. One is this first little business about surface tension, and the collisions really were occurring all the time. And the second one is the cooling of the turbulence. Now actually, there's no guarantee that the turbulence is going to have exactly as much kinetic energy as the initial expansion. So you can put a little fudge factor, F in there if you want. As long as it's not too small, you can be fairly confident that you're not totally misleading yourself. Okay, so this is what you do. You take this formula, and then you calculate the collision velocity between drops of size S by putting in for lambda here, S divided by R cubed. That's the size divided by epsilon that we were discussing before. Now this is just, wrong way. Yeah. Senior moment. at least I recognize it. Okay, good. So we have that. Okay, so we put that in, we crank away, and we can calculate how the drop sizes evolve as this turbulence expands. But the drop sizes don't evolve forever. Oh, I should say one more thing for the cosmologists here. This is a Hubble flaw, of course. This was the Big Bang. The impact was the Big Bang. The stuff comes out. After a while, there's a very good relation between the distance that any fluid particle finds itself from the impact site and the time. So you get a Hubble flow, but of course the turbulence is a decaying part. In fact, there were even theories, I think, of galaxy formation based on turbulent universe, which cooled off. These have disappeared. And most of you probably aren't old enough to remember them, but I am. So this is a Hubble flow with a little bit of perturbation around it. And everybody knows what happens to interactions in a Hubble flow. They freeze out. After a while, the interaction rates become smaller than the Hubble constant. The Hubble constant is just given by this U0. Hubble constant is U0 divided by R, or U0 divided by R0 times 1 over little r. You have an evolving Hubble constant here. And so everything freezes out. And then when things freeze out, then we have the final size distribution. But there are a couple of tricky things here. Not everything freezes out at the same time. The collisions of the small or the minimum size drops, they continue longer than the time scale over which the big drops freeze out, and so you have to take that into account. But none of it is particularly difficult for a cosmologist. For a geologist like me, though, it's an accomplishment. Okay, so we get the freeze out here, and when we do that, we find this is very simple. We find that the little drops, if we use a 1 kilometer size scale for the initial r, and we use 2 kilometers per second for u zero, that the little drops freeze out at expansion factor little r of about 30, so maybe 30 kilometers, well above the atmosphere. System is still very, very optically thick. It hasn't lost any of its internal energy to radiation yet. And the big drops, the biggest ones, might be 100 times bigger. They froze out when expansion factor was maybe 10 times. The law was about 10. Okay, that's the main thing I wanted to talk about. I don't want to overstress you. But now, I want to talk about these things a little, because this part I still don't completely understand. if you look at the equilibria of fluid bodies under surface tension, they're very simple. If you imagine taking a certain mass of fluid and giving it, endowing it with some angular momentum, then it basically has two classes of shapes, stable shapes. There are only two classes. If the angular momentum is small enough, basically, if the angular momentum is such that the centrifugal acceleration at the surface is small compared to what surface tension can support, then you just get a spheroid. Start with a sphere with zero rotation, you work up to a spheroid. But when the spheroid gets to a certain ellipticity of order unity, then it turns out energetically it's favorable to bifurcate into a two-lobe sequence in which the two lobes are the same, but in which the cross-section of a given lobe is not circular, flattened. So this thing was spinning this way. Probably it's something like spinning like that. Yeah, it's something like 10 hertz, or maybe it was 10 radians per second. I don't remember, but anyway, it was spinning like that. Okay, a little bit more spin, and it couldn't survive. There are no more equilibria. There's a sort of maximum angular momentum, which per unit mass, which a system like this can have. And then if it's viscous, it sort of pulls apart. And where's my other stuff? Yeah. Where's my... there they are. Okay, now I just want to show you the teardrop. So one of these is a teardrop. Yeah. Okay. So here's a teardrop. In fact, whoops, this cross-section becomes more and more round as you approach this critical limit. And then if you pull off, you get something like this. Now, the question is, where did this happen? Did it happen in this flow of droplets? I tried to see if that was possible. And I think not. Because if you look at these the formation of these big drops, they do basically, or they're controlled by collisions with, as I said, larger than average, but still much smaller drops, which just have enough kinetic energy in the center of mass to balance the surface energy of the big drop. And those collisions get rather little angular momentum, very small compared to critical angular momentum. In other words, if you want to have a collision of a big drop with something that spins it up to near its maximum angular momentum, then that collision is going to give much too much center mass energy for the system to survive at all, vibrate and break apart. So that's not the answer. There's a possibility, although I'm not all that enthusiastic about it, just the vorticity and the turbulence that collected into one of these big drops, which it collects from a fairly local region, is enough to get it spin. But it makes it hard to understand something like this, because at the time that these big drops were forming, they were really quite hot, and viscosity was negligible. And this sort of thing wouldn't stay in this shape if there was very low viscosity. You need really quite high viscosity, something like 10 to the 4 times the viscosity of water, to keep this thing in a shape like this long enough for it to cool, even if it's out in the open.
Maybe it just hits the ocean and at this point it kind of, you know.
Yeah, so I think, okay, so I think, but I don't know, I think that the most likely explanation is that when these things came back into the atmosphere, these, by the way, take quite a long time to cool. Something like this takes about as long to cool as it takes to go several thousand kilometers. Thermal diffusivity, the cooling depends on a combination of the thermal diffusivity, the time it takes heat to get out from the inside, that's just having the phonons diffuse. They go a few lattice distances at a couple kilometers per second, that determines the thermal diffusivity. It's the same for all insulators, essentially. And it also depends upon the heat radiating away. And this high silica material, this glass material, it's glass because it has very high viscosity and melt, so it doesn't solidify in crystal, it just does it in glass, even if you keep it there for hours. If I melted this and sat it down, hours later it would still be glass, cool off, it's still be glass. So this sort of thing, when it came down, was still pretty plastic. And my guess was the shock of hitting the atmosphere probably was enough to cause it to spin, and in this case to pull apart, but it wasn't so low viscosity, it was able to keep that shape, but I don't know. And it still worries me. I have that open part question, so I don't really know the answer to that one. Okay, I guess that's about it. If I have a completely different talk here with pictures, I don't know how useful they are. If you want to see what microtektites actually look like, I have pictures of North American microtektites.
We put it on the wiki.
It's not, I mean, they're just little spherules that have been dragged out of the ocean floor. So that's basically it.
So this could be used to learn from the size and timing of the impacts?
Well, there are better ways. What I would say, though, is that for the KT boundary impact, which was much bigger than the others that we know about in recent times being 100 million years, the spherule is a little bit bigger. And these scalings that I get suggest that the size of scale is something like the amount of material or the radius of the melt when it comes out of the ground to the roughly 1/2 pallet. But they also scale inversely with the speed at which the stuff comes out. The amount of material, though, estimated from the seafloor, is comparable to the size of the impactors. That's consistent with the size of the highly shocked zone around the impact when it occurs. There are other interesting features. That is, this material is almost all terrestrial material. But if you go far enough away from the impact site, you tend to see more of the extraterrestrial material. Start to see iridium, for example, other platinum groups, siderophile elements. These elements that are very rare in the Earth's crust because they're ion lovers. They've all been sucked into the core. So there is a mixture of terrestrial material and projectile material, and it sorts out as a function of distance. So you can learn something, but maybe it's an exercise in turbulence, I think. I mean, the previous explanations have been completely unconvincing to me. They all depend upon nucleation in a vapor cloud. First place, most of this material was never vapor. It was always liquid. You can tell that because there's no compositional stratification. If you had the thing all vaporized and then recondensed, you would get some things condensed first and then other things condensed around them. You wouldn't get uniform density. A uniform composition. So I think the turbulence is probably right. I haven't published it yet, though. Okay, anyway, that's it.